Okay. Our next speaker is Luca Moretti from Sydney University, and he will speak about the ontological status of minimal entities.
Okay. So I'm supposed to speak about these weird entities called minimal or pleonastic or deflationary entities. These entities have been investigated by, among others, Schiffer, Thomason, Hof-Weber. And the problem of minimal entities is connected with the problem of creeping minimalism. But I'm not going to speak of creeping minimalism, otherwise my paper explode. I just concentrate on the problem of minimal entities. Roughly speaking, minimal entities are those that fall under minimal notions, where the latter are defined in terms of only platitudinal principle. For example, the platitude that define a minimal fact is this, S, if and only if it is a fact that S. Okay. In this paper, I do basically three things. First, I provide a precise characterization of the minimal notion of a fact, a property, and a proposition, which is inspired to all each minimal notion of truths. And the idea, the claim I try to support is that all these notions have the essential function of allowing for the explicit formulation of generalizations in situations of partial information. Okay, after that, I argue that we are committed, plausibly, we are committed to the existence of the entity that falls under these minimal notions, so a fact, a property, and a proposition. And finally, I investigate the ontological status of these minimal entities. The question I ask basically is this: are these entities fully existent, like cat, dogs, electrons, you and me, or are they something that we just project onto the world by our linguistic practices? I try to argue that the second option is the true one. Minimal entities are just linguistic posits, and they exist only intrinsically to language. I think this is intuitive, but we need some argument for this because we are philosophers. Okay, so the points are these of my talk. First, I introduce the notion of a pleonastic entity, which is similar to the one of a minimal entity. And after that, I extend all which characterization of minimal truths to other entities to explain what a minimal entity is. I will argue that we are committed to the existence of minimal entities. And finally, I will argue that minimal entities are just linguistic posits. OK, how we start thinking of minimal entities? Think of this kind of inferences. OK, first, we can ask this question. Are there facts, for example? And there is a trivial answer. Yes, there are. Think of this. I started with saying that today is Friday. From this, I infer it is a fact that today is Saturday. Sorry, Saturday, Friday. I made a mistake. It is a fact that today is Friday. I can't believe it. It's so stupid. And from this, I infer, so there is a fact, namely, that today is Friday. I can't believe it. OK, so but you understand that it was supposed to be Friday, not Saturday, OK? So this inference appears to be trivially correct, at least in ordinary discourse, if you replace Saturday with Friday, of course. So I can answer, yes, there are facts. Why do you worry about this? The same question about properties. I ask, are there properties? OK, I start with this. This apple is red. From this, I can infer. This apple has the property of being red. And then I infer the property of being red is exemplified by this apple. And then, eventually, there is something instantiated by this apple, or exemplified by this apple, the property of being red. So there are properties. This inference seems to be trivial somehow. OK. Again, think of propositions. Are there propositions? Yes, today is Friday. Yes, I said Friday again. Yeah, OK. Today is Friday. From this, I infer the proposition that today is Friday is true. And then there is something too, namely the proposition that today is Friday. OK. And so it seems, again, that there are propositions. Of course, if we start wondering about why these inferences are correct, we have to say that the notions we are using here of facts, propositions, and properties are not metaphysically thick notions, are something very thin, very trivial, very obvious. If they were thicker than these, probably we can reject this kind of inferences. So now I'm going to explore what we mean when we say that entities of this kind are thin. And I will call these entities minimal entities. OK, but let's see what Schiffer has to say about this kind of inferences. Schiffer calls the inferences we saw before something from nothing transformations or inferences. These inferences are such that we move from one sentence in which there is no reference to an entity of a given type, for example, a proposition, to another sentence in which there is a reference to an entity of that type. So for Schiffer, we can use these kind of transformations to introduce in our ontology many different entities like proposition, properties, facts, events, states, truths, and maybe others. OK, Hofweber, who focused on the problem of minimal entity, distinguished two steps in this kind of inferences. The first step, at least two steps, is called nominalizations because we introduce a known phrase. For example, from today is Saturday, we infer, today is Friday, we infer the proposition that today is Saturday is true, and the proposition that today is Saturday is a known phrase. After that, we quantify on the proposition that today is Saturday. So we can call this step a quantification. So from the proposition that today is Saturday is true, we infer there is, there exists something true, namely proposition that today is Friday. OK. Sorry, let me check it. Friday, Saturday, I'm crazy. OK. According to Schiffer, we can characterize pleonastic entity as those whose existence is typically secured by something from nothing transformations. Schiffer emphasized that these kind of entities don't have any hidden or substantial nature waiting to be uncovered. And all essential truths about them are determined a priori by our linguistic practices that are constitutive of the concept of them, together with other a priori truths. For example, if X is identical to Y, X and Y share all properties. So what are the a priori principles that define pleonastic concept, the pleonastic concept I mentioned before? At least, in my opinion, but I think it's quite obvious, the platitudinous schemata appeal to at the step of nominalizations and also intermediate steps. For example, for properties, at least the schemata A is P if and only if A has the property of being P, and the other, I use both of them in my inferences. A has the property of being P if and only if the property of being P is instantiated by A. And for facts and proposition, respectively, at least the following schemata. S if and only if it is a fact that S, and S if and only if the proposition that S is true. Okay. In this case, A stands for for something which functions syntactically as a singular term, P stands for something that functions syntactically as a predicate, and A is P, and S satisfy at least superficial constraints of truth's aptitude. OK, so in ordinary discourse, we can make this kind of inferences. But why do we do this? What's the function of something from nothing transformations? Schiffer doesn't answer this general question. OK, but notice the one thing that you should notice is that the principle that ground something from nothing transformation are not metaphysically substantive. Think of this principle, for example. Star, A is P if and only if A exemplifies the universal P-ness. Okay? The the proposition that A is P is true if and only if the individual A is and the property P in the set theoretic construction, okay, that one, are such that A exemplifies P. These are substantive claims that a metaphysician can accept or not. If our something from nothing transformation presuppose these kind of principles, you could reject them if you reject these principles. Okay, so you can say that this kind of trivial transformation presupposes anything so substantive. But so what's the function of this kind of transformations? For example, if you accept star, we can explain the so-called phenomenon of attribute agreement, at least for some philosophers this is true. But if you accept the platitudes about property that I call I and II, you can't explain anything. Okay, so they don't have any explanatory, probably, role in our language. So what's the function of this something from nothing transformation and also of pleonastic entities? Okay, now I'm trying to put forward a view about this. Okay, let's focus on Orrich minimal truths, and I want to suggest that the function of the principle that ground something from nothing transformation and also of the something from nothing transformation is the same function as the equivalence schema according to Orrich. According to Orrich, the equivalence schema, which is, okay, of course, S if and only if it is true that S, is the one that defines the minimal notion of truths. According to Orrich, the minimal notion of truths is no substantive property. For example, it doesn't, it's not some kind of correspondence with mind-independent reality, but it's not even idealized justification or any kind of justification. For Orrich, minimal truths is just a logical device grounded in ES with the essential function of allowing the explicit formulation of blind generalizations. My suggestion is that we can think of minimal notions, the minimal notions of a fact, a proposition, and a property, in the same way. Minimal notions are, in this sense, precisifications of corresponding pleonastic notions. Now, it will become clear why I think so. Okay, first, let's focus on Orrich. Okay, what does it mean that ES is a device for generalizing? Suppose I want to endorse what John has asserted, so although I don't know what he said. And if I knew it, so I can just reassert it. I cannot state there exists an X such that X and X has been asserted by John, because the first X is no statement, it's a variable, I can't assert it. So it's not a well-formed sentence. But I can, however, express my belief with a turn of phrase that alludes to a potentially infinite disjunction of conjunction. For example, that Hegel was tall has been asserted by John, and Hegel was tall. Or that Melbourne is cold has been asserted by John, and Melbourne is cold, or and so on. Okay, to obtain an explicit generalization from this turn of phrase, I can apply the equivalence schema. So I can reformulate by applying it this turn of phrase in this way. That Hegel was tall has been asserted by John, and that Hegel was tall is true. Or that Melbourne is cold has been recently asserted by John. There is a mistake here. And that Melbourne is cold is true, and so on. Okay. And now I can generalize because I have the predicate is true. I can say there is an X such that X has been asserted by John, and X is true. So I obtain a well-formed generalization. Colloquially, there is something true that has been asserted by John. Okay, I think we can think of other platitudes as a device for generalizing in the same way. The first platitude we saw before, I think it was the one about propositions, that says that, no, it's not the first, it's the fourth. S if and only if the proposition that S is true. Okay, we can use this device in the same way as before, but I don't want to go through this because you can see that this platitude is just a way to restate the equivalence schema. It is generally accepted that the equivalence schema, in the equivalence schema, that clause is a clause that refers to propositions. So for is just a reproposition of the equivalence schema. So we can use the same mechanism as before to obtain a well-formed generalization by starting from the turn of phrase that you remember. Let's focus on something more interesting. Let's consider the platitude about fact. In particular, S if and only if it is a fact that S. Okay, suppose I want to express my belief that there is something that John does know, although I don't know what it is. So I can express my belief with the following turn of phrase that alludes to a potentially infinite disjunction of conjunction. Hegel was told and this is known by John. Melbourne is called and this is known by John, or and so on. But I can apply the platitude I mentioned before. I can obtain that Hegel was told is a fact and this is known by John. That Melbourne is called is a fact and this is known by John, and so on. Again, I can generalize now because I have the predicate is a fact, and I obtain there is X, an X such that X is a fact, and X is known by John. Colloquially, there is a fact that John knows. Now, let's do the same with properties. Do you think I'm too slow? Okay. So the platitudes are, in this case, A is P if and only if A has the property of being P, and the second was A has the property of being P if and only if the property of being P is instantiated by A. So suppose I want to say that Vegemite and Marmite share some property or feature, though I don't know what property or feature it is. A way to do is to use a turn of phrase again that alludes to an infinite disjunction of conjunction. In this case, it is Vegemite is boldness, for example, curative, and Marmite is boldness, curative. Or Vegemite is shyness, curative, and Marmite is shyness, curative, or and so on. Okay. By appealing to the platitudes I mentioned before, I can obtain these transformation. I can transform the turn of phrase into this. The property of being bold and curative is instantiated by Vegemite, and the property of being bold and curative is instantiated by Marmite. Or the property of being shyness curative is instantiated by Vegemite, and the property of being shyness curative is instantiated by Marmite, and so on. From this, I can generalize. There is an X such that X is instantiated by Vegemite, and X is instantiated by Marmite. More informally, Vegemite and Marmite share some property. So this is the general idea that we can use this kind of stupid inferences. So stupid principles, not inferences, to obtain blind generalization or generalization in situations of lack of information. So in analogy with the characterization of Horwich's minimal truths, I propose to characterize the minimal notions of a property, a factor, and a proposition only through the relevant platitudes that, in conjunction with ordinary accepted logical rules, allow for the explicit formulation of blind generalization. And the platitudes are the same I mentioned before. So I, double I, triple I, and four I's. Okay, I don't want to go through them. You know this by heart. Possibly there are further minimal notions that can be characterized in the same way. So now I say that minimal entities are those that fall under minimal notions characterized as above. Minimal entities have no features other than those that can be attributed to them a priori on the grounds of the platitudinous schemata that define them. So minimal entities don't coincide with pleonastic entities in Schiffer's sense, which are theoretically thicker, because he thinks there are other principles that apply to this, that by means of which we can characterize pleonastic entities. For example, Schiffer believes that it is a priori principle, definitive of pleonastic entity, that pleonastic properties are not in space and time. So he adds something more. I don't consider this kind of principles. Okay, for minimal entities, okay? So some remarks. Horwich is monist about truths. For him, the only workable notion of truth we can characterize is the minimal notion. In contrast, I believe that we can be pluralist about the notions of fact, property, and proposition, in the sense that we can characterize other notions of the same kind. We can think of thicker facts, for example, facts that apply to physical discourse or to science and so on, that probably are plausibly are characterized in terms of other principles. So this form of pluralism, and also with property and so on, so there are thin and thick properties, thin and thick facts, thin and thick propositions. Okay, this form of pluralism is somehow analogous to right pluralism about truths, according to which we possess the minimal notion of truths and also more substantive notion of truths suitable to different areas of discourse. But the analogy is not perfect because for right, When we think of the minimal notion of truth, we think of a notion which is characterized in terms of only a priori principle that any competent speaker is typically supposed to accept to use the truth predicate correctly. In my case, when I characterize minimal notions, I characterize them in terms of only some of them. The platitudes that I consider, probably there are other platitudes. For example, platitudes in case of proposition that connect propositional attitudes to propositions or to truths and so on. I didn't consider this kind of platitudes. Okay, now, I try to argue that we are committed to the existence of minimal entities. Okay, so we can say now that minimal entities and not only pleonastic entities are introduced in ontology via something from nothing inferences. So now we can also say that we know that there are at least two steps in this kind of inferences. And we can ask questions about the grounds of the justification of these steps. The justification of the step of nominalizations and intermediate steps, I'm speaking of properties when speaking of intermediate steps because there are two platitudes involved, not one as in the other cases. We can justify the step of nominalization on the basis of the a priori principles from 1 to 4 that characterize essentially these minimal entities. These principles are plausibly conceptually true. We accept them as conceptually true in ordinary discourse. There are more problems with the step of quantifications, and now I'm focusing on it. But I can say now that the step of quantification, maybe is obvious, can be justified on the basis of the logical function that these minimal entities have that is allowing for the formulation of blind generalization. In other words, in order to fulfill this function, we have to quantify over minimal entities. So probably the step of quantification is justified. But let's see this in more details. So what is the justification of the step of quantification? If you consider the inferential schemata that underlie the steps of quantification in all three inferences I consider, you see these three schemata. First, it is a fact that S, from this we infer there exists something X such that X is identical to that S, and X is a fact. Second, the proposition that S is true, from this we infer there exists an X such that X is identical to the proposition that S, and X is true. The fourth, about property, is the property of being P is instantiated by A. From this we infer there exists an X such that X is identical to the property of being P, and X is instantiated by A. In general, all these three schemata presuppose this more general schema. B is Q, entails there exists an X such that X is identical to B and X is Q. While B functions syntactically as a singular term, Q functions syntactically as a predicate, and B is Q satisfy at least superficial constraints of truth's aptitude. Of course, E is a theorem of predicate logic with identity. We can drop it if we appeal to an appropriate free logic. But if we do this, minimal entities don't have any longer the function of allowing for the explicit formulation of existential generalization. For fulfilling that function requires accepting this schema as valid. B is Q. In case there is an X such that X is Q. If we accept this schema E star and we introduce a symbol of identity, we are committed to accepting also E. B is Q, in case X is identical to B and X is Q. Okay, so I think this is the reason why we have also to accept the step of quantification in the trivial something from nothing inferences. Okay, now, it seems to me that it follows from at least a formulation of Quine's criterion of ontological commitment that we are committed, at least prima facie, to minimal entities. This ontological commitment, this criterion, can be formulated in this way. Accepting a first order sentence S for language L as true carries commitment to given entities, if and only if these entities must be included among those over which the variables of L range in order for S to be true. On this criterion, we appear committed to the existence of minimal entity, precisely in case in which we accept as true the basic sentence from which a something from nothing inference starts. For example, I accept for true that today is Friday. From this I infer it is a fact that today is Friday. And from this I infer there is an X such that X is identical that today is Friday and X is a fact. In order for 3 to be true, a fact must be counted among the entities over which X ranges. As trivially, 3 says that X is a fact. So we have to accept that it's true that today is... If we accept that it's true that today is Friday, we must accept that a fact exists. Okay, we can try to elude this kind of commitment. I mean, there are many ways. One is to reject the quine ontological commitment. I'm not going to do this. I mean, it is possible to show that this criterion, even if very intuitive, is problematic. But I prefer to accept this criterion, at least in the formulation I gave before. But are there other ways? For example, we can try to be error theorists about minimal entities. But I think in this case we have a lot of problems, because error theory about X entities, for example, numbers or moral properties, typically claim that the sentences about X entities, entailing that X entities exist, are all false, as no X entity exists. But in this case, if we try to do the same, and if we say, for example, that the proposition that asserts that there is a fact is false, we have to go back by modus tollens and say that it is false that today is Friday. And we don't want to say that today is Friday is false sometimes, in many cases. So I think it's not prudent to try to develop this view. We can try to be fictionalist. But also in this case, there are problems. Of course, I'm very rough. I mean, I just try to speak a little bit about different perspectives, and after we focus on one in particular. But there are problems with these different perspectives. So, about fictionalism. If you are a fictionalist about X entities, generally, when you say that there are X entities, you don't assert that for real that there are X entities. You just pretend to do that. This is at least one version of fictionalism. But in our case, since we infer, for example, the proposition that there exists fact from the proposition that there exists the fact that today is Friday exists from the proposition that today is Friday, we infer logically, and we accept the first claim as true. We have to accept the final claim as true. And if we assert the first, it seems that we are committed to assert also the conclusion of the inference. And so it's difficult to be fictionalist about minimal entities. We can try to be non-cognitivist about minimally entities. But also in this case, there are problems because the inferences are logical inferences. So they are the claims involved in the inferences are at least minimally truth-apt. But if you are a non-cognitivist, generally you reject the truth-aptness, aptitude of the claims involved. And in this case, you can't do that. You cannot do that. Maybe you can say that if the claims involved in the something from nothing inferences are just deflationary truth-apt or minimally truth-apt, there is no real ontological commitment, but also, yes, you can say this, but after you have to explain why, and this is not so simple. Okay, anyway, I'm going to explore something similar to this claim, that since everything is deflationary, there is no real commitment to minimal entity eventually. Okay, so again, another possibility, we can appeal to substitutional quantification. Yes, we can try. Hofweber proposed this. If we appeal to substitutional quantification, as you know, we don't have a domain of quantification, so you can say that you don't refer to minimal entities when you speak of them. And so we are not committed to the existence of minimal entities, even if we assert there are minimal entities. In particular, consider again the general schema that underlies the step of quantification. The schema E, B is Q, entails exists an X, there exists an X such that X is identical to B, and X is Q. On the objectual reading of quantifiers, which presupposes standard Taskian semantics for predicate logic, the existential statement is true if and only if there is an individual X in the domain of quantification that satisfies the open formula X is identical to B and X is Q, and this is the case if and only if B refers to X and X belongs to the extension of Q. On the substitution reading of quantifiers, which presupposes truth value semantics for predicate logic, the same existential statement is true if and only if there is at least one substitution for the variable X with an individual constant C such that the formula C identical to B and C is Q is true. And this is the case if and only if both atomic sentences C is identical to B and C is Q are true. Moreover, in truth value semantics, the truth value of the atomic sentences is given as basic, like in propositional logic. Since there is no domain of quantification, no individual constants refers, and no open sentences can be satisfied. So you can say that, okay, there is no real commitment because we can speak of truths. We can say that our claims are true, but in order to account for the truths of these statements, we don't have to require that X ranges over any entity whatsoever. Okay, if we accept substitutional quantification. Okay, but there is a problem. The problem is that we can surely appeal to deflationary notions of a semantical notion. For example, consider the one I called RIF or REF. There is this, for every X, if X is identical, X is identical to B, if and only if B, in quotation marks, refers to X. Consider this other. For every X, X is Q, if and only if X belongs to the extension of Q. They are trivial, they are deflationary. Everyone is supposed to accept this. Or satisfaction. For every X, X is identical to B and X is Q, if and only if X satisfies the open formula, the relevant open formula. Given these deflationary notions, the advocate of substitutional quantification is committed to asserting exactly what the advocate of objectual quantification says. You can obtain straightforwardly this by inference. If there is an X such that X is identical to B and X is Q if this is true if and only if there is an individual X that satisfies in a deflationary sense the open formula. And this is the case if and only if B refers in a deflationary sense to X, and X belongs to the extension of Q in a deflationary sense. So the advocate of substitutional quantification is committed to claim that the existential statement is true if and only if X ranges in a deflationary sense over something, namely something that in a deflationary sense can be referred to by B, belongs to the extension in a deflationary sense of Q, and thus satisfy the open formula in a deflationary sense. But then the truths of the existential statement requires X to range in a deflationary sense over QS. If Q stands for a fact, the advocate of substitutional quantification appears committed to the existential of minimal facts because the existential statement was the last step of quantification. Okay, in the inferences, something from nothing inferences, and this result can repropose for the other minimal entities. Of course, you can say, oh, but look, all your notions are deflationary, so there is no real ontological commitment. At least there is a deflationary ontological limit. I think there is something true in this claim, but it is not so easy to understand what we mean when we say this. And now I'm trying to flesh it out. Okay, so in fact, the conclusion is that minimal entities are linguistic posits. Okay, let's start with the problem. When we speak, okay, we saw what minimal entities are and in which kind, in what way we get committed, maybe in a deflationary sense, to their existence. And everything is very puzzling. So we start investigating about the nature of this entity, let's say the ontological status. Are they real? Are not real? What does it mean, this? Okay, let's start with a very simple question. We can ask, are these entities mind-dependent or mind-independent? You can say, oh, yeah, maybe they are mind-dependent because it's at least intuitive that they are so, because they are too trivial to be real. But unfortunately, you don't get this result. Let's start with this claim, which is probably true. Possibly there is no mind, and the moon is round. Given the obvious platitude we obtain, possibly there is no mind, and it is a fact that the moon is round. Again, from this we infer, possibly there is no mind, and there exists something X, which is identical to that the moon is round, and X is a fact. So you can infer from this that minimal facts are mind-dependent, because they can exist without the existence of minds. Okay, and Amy Thomason derives from example like this that in certain cases, minimal entities exist mind-independently. So they are substantive entities. Okay, maybe we can accept this. But so we can conclude that minimal entities are mind-independent. No, because let's suppose that you are an anti-realist. Dammett recently accepted the claim that if there is no mind, there is nothing. Okay, so he's an anti-realist. And so if, as an anti-realist, he denies one. He put a negation operator in front of possible. So he says, it is impossible that there is no mind and the moon is round. From this, he infers, it is impossible that there is no mind and it is a fact that the moon is round. From this, he infers, it is impossible that there is no mind and there exists an X such that X is the fact that the moon is round. So in this case, it seems that minimal facts are mind dependent, because they cannot exist without minds. So the puzzling conclusion is that whether a minimal entity exists mind dependently or independently hinges on whether what is described by the basic sentence from which the relevant something from nothing inference originates, for example, the moon is round, exists respectively mind independently or mind dependently. So you can say, the minimal entities are neutral to realism and enter and non-realism, but this is weird. We can think of appealing to more sophisticated criteria of my dependence and my independence, but we obtain the same result. For example, a much more sophisticated criterion of mind dependence is this: necessary for the state of affair that S. So if the state of affair of S is mind dependent, if and only if this condition is satisfied. Necessary, S, if and only if. If there was an epistemic agent in good condition to judge whether S, she would assert that S. And the connected criterion for mind independence is this. Possibly, S is true, and it is false that if there was an epistemic agent in good condition to judge whether S, she would assert that S. But you can see immediately that also if we apply this kind of criteria, we obtain exactly the same result, because the problem is S. We can replace S with the moon is round, and we arrive at saying that there exists something S, which is the fact that the moon is round. If S was mind independent, the minimal fact is mind independent. If the original S was mind dependent, the minimal fact is mind dependent. So it doesn't work to try to make the criteria for mind dependence and independence more sophisticated. Okay, but I think there is a problem with this attempt, because we have to distinguish between realism and non-realism about the world and about ontology. I think that the criteria for mind dependence and mind independence we have considered apply to the world, but probably they are problematic when we try to apply these to the debate, to use them in the debate between realists and non-realists about ontology. Realism and non-realism about ontology concerns not just the world, but the structure of the world. Namely, it concerns the things and the type of things the world itself organizes into, for example, facts, properties, individuals, events, etc. The debate about ontological realism and non-realism are typical disputes about whether a given description of the world carves reality at its joints. Okay, if we are non-realist about the world, we also are non-realists about ontology. This seems to me intuitive. If the world is mind-dependent, everything is mind-dependent. But if we are realists about the world, we might still be either realist or non-realist about ontology. For example, about specific ontological items such as property or facts. The problem is that the criteria we saw, for example, the criteria of mind-dependence, sophisticated criteria of mind-dependence and mind-independence, don't seem to account for the latter possibility, the possibility that we are realists about the world, but anti-realists about some particular ontological item. Okay? Because it seems that if I'm a realist about the state of affairs concerning that chair, which is red, I'm also a realist about the minimal fact that that chair is red, but maybe I don't believe in facts, even if I believe that there is a chair over there which is red. And I have to account for this possibility. Okay, so I think that if we want to investigate the ontological status of minimal entity, we have to focus on different criteria, criteria that are useful in the ontological debate about realism and non-realism. We need the criteria for ontological realism and non-realism to answer the question whether minimal entities are real or, in some sense, non-real. Okay, so what can be a criterion we can apply to? Consider the Eleatic criterion. The Eleatic criterion says that everything that exists must make a difference to the causal powers of something. Schiffer suggests that adding pleonastic and so minimal entities to our ontology doesn't disturb the pre-existing causal order because the addition is conservative. Okay. So if minimal entities don't disturb the pre-existing causal order, it might be argued that minimal entities are not real because they don't satisfy the Eleatic criterion. One problem is that the Eleatic criterion is not universally accepted. For example, people who accept the existence of possible and abstract entities, they reject it. But there is another problem, that appealing to this criterion is not illuminating, because we arrive at the puzzle. Consider a realist about the world. As we have seen, it would seem that this realist committed to asserting that minimal entities exist mind independently, okay, at least in some cases. And this seems to qualify them as real entities in an intuitive sense. So a conclusion might be, if we apply the Eleatic criterion, that these entities are real, although they don't disturb the pre-existing causal order. They exist mind-independently. They don't have causal power, but who cares? They are, in a strong sense, intuitive sense, they are real because they are mind-independent. And so there is something here that doesn't work. Okay, let's go on. Schiffer suggested another reason why minimal entities are not real. Schiffer suggests that these pleonastic entities, and so minimal entities, are not fully real because the essential features or real things can be discovered by a posteriori scientific investigation, while the essential features of pleonastic entities can be known only a priori by reading them off the relevant linguistic practices. Okay, so in his opinion, we can infer from this that minimal entities, pleonastic entities, are not real. But I think we can question this claim, because consider a full-blooded realist about propositions. The realist doesn't seem committed to believing that the essential features of proposition can be discovered a posteriori. She could believe instead that the essential feature of proposition can be known a priori through the knowledge of relevant conceptually true sentences or the correlated linguistic practices. Entertaining this belief requires endorsing the thesis that an analytically sentence S or conceptually true sentence S, which can be known a priori can be known a priori to be two is two in virtue of not its meaning, but of independent states of affair. But there are philosophers who argue that this thesis is true. In particular, Bogosian gave recently arguments to support this thesis. So if we follow Bogosian, we reject the criterion proposed by Schiffer, according to which, since minimal entities are just a priori knowable, in their essence, they are not real. Okay, so now I put forward my proposal. The reason why, in my opinion, minimal entities are not genuinely real becomes evident as we realize that the deepest and the most complete explanation of our ability to refer to minimal entities can be given by making use of mere deflationary notions of reference, for example, the deflationary notion of reference I presented before. Indeed, it seems that reference to minimal entity can be explained only in terms of deflationary semantical notions. For it would make no sense to try to use any substantive, for example, causal, semi-causal, or semi-causal notion of reference to explain it. A causal or semi-causal notion of reference would apply to minimal entities if the latter had causal powers, like ordinary objects or scientific objects. Yet the minimal entities have causal powers, that minimal entities have causal powers is not stated by the platitudinous principles that characterize in full the nature of these objects. Thus, minimal entities are probably causally inert. Of course, we can add further principle to make minimal entities metaphysically thicker, but in that case, they are not minimal entities anymore. If minimal entities exist in extrinsically to language, the deepest and the most complete explanation of our ability to refer to them would have to involve more complex notion of reference. For we would have to clarify how our words can hook up to entities extrinsic to language. Deflationary notions of reference can establish by themselves no link between language and extra-linguistic world. The conclusion we should draw, I think, is that minimal entities cannot be but intrinsic to language. In this sense, they are linguistic projections or linguistic posits. Okay, now, how can we make everything coherent? Because there is this story that the realist about the world claims that minimal entities are mind independent. And I just claim that in some sense, minimal entities are not real. So probably we cannot say that they are mind independent, or we have to qualify this claim. But I think we can make the picture coherent. Suppose I'm a realist about ordinary objects, so that I believe that it is mind independent that this apple is round, but I'm not a realist about facts. Okay, I can still use the expression, the fact that this apple is round in a deflationary way, by applying the platitude according to which S, if and only if it is a fact that S. I can speak of facts, even if I don't believe that they are metaphysically substantive objects. And I suppose I derive from the two sentences, one, that this apple is round, the sentence, it is a fact that this apple is round, and then the sentence, there exists a fact, which is the fact that this apple is round. I can still maintain that 1, 2, and 3 describe the same mind-independent reality, although the singular term that this apple is round and the predicate is a fact, or it is a fact, in 2 and 3 refer to nothing existing out of language. To obtain this result, I have to use a semantical model in which Taskian semantics applies to 1, to the claim 1, this apple is round. In this case, the quantification domain includes language-independent objects. And truth value semantics applies to 2 and 3, with the stipulation that the truth value of 2 and of 3 are identical to that the truth value of 1. Finally, I apply on deflationary semantical notion to 2 and 3. Platitude 3, S, if and only if it is a fact that S, in this case, function as a bridging principle to move from Taskian semantics to truth value semantics and vice versa. Okay, we can also add now that on this semantical assumption, the existential quantifier in 3, there exists an X such that, that the quantifier that quantifies on facts is just a deflationary or minimal quantifier. So we could say that minimal facts and other minimal notions just have a deflationary or minimal existence. Okay. It seems that this view is, I mean, it seems complicated. I have to stop.
You've been going for 52 minutes.
Okay, I'm very close to this view, even if seems might seem complicated, I think is coherent with the common assumption that the same mind-independent reality can be described in alternative ways by means of alternative conceptualization or alternative linguistic conventions, where not all components of these alternative descriptions reflect the items of the mind-independent reality. Consider, for example, my cat is in Sydney, and all undetached parts of my cat are in Sydney. I can say intuitively that these two statements describe the same mind-independent states of affairs, but the expression, the undetached part of my cat, probably doesn't refer to anything, or it refers to a better, to a linguistic projection, which is nothing that exists in the world. So as a realist about the world and a non-realist about facts, I can maintain that when I infer this apple is round, from this apple is round via the platitude 3 and the criterion for mind independence, the sophisticated one I mentioned before, that it is mind independent that there exists an X such that X is identical to that this apple is round and X is a fact, the feature of being mind independent doesn't concern what is referred to by this apple is round and what belongs to the extension of is a fact. For the semantical notion that apply to this expression are just deflationary and they don't hook up to anything existing in the world. I spoke of facts, but we can apply the same to the other minimal entities. So what I did is this. First, I have given a precise characterization of minimal notions of a fact, a property, and a proposition inspired to all which characterization of minimal truths, according to which these minimal notions have the essential function of allowing for the explicit formulation of blind generalization. After that, I have argued that on quantum criterion of ontological commitment, we are plausibly committed to the existence of minimal entities, the entities that falls under these notions. I've also argued that these entities are not genuinely real because they exist only intrinsically to language and for referential issues. The reason being that the best explanation of reference to minimal entities makes use of only deflation and semantical notions, so we don't get out from language. I have suggested that we do possess the semantical tools, basically Taskian semantics and truth value semantics, to show that this kind of non-realism about minimal entities, ontological non-realism, is compatible with realism about the world. Okay, I've finished.
So first you have the normalization step.
The
right?
Substitution existential step.
Yeah.
Okay.
So but Hofweber's theory is the substitutional step, it's not normalization and then the substitutional step, right?
Okay.
It seems like that you should want to call that a substitutional step, given that you say that there's no commitment in the real sense to objects in the world. So I was wondering why you would want to say that we are actually committed in the Quinean sense to objects, because for Quine, the quantifiers are objectual and not substitutional, right? There's some real connection between the language and the world in Quine's sense of commitment. Whereas when you say we're committed to these entities, it seems like you mean it in some lesser sense.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And
yes.
So why would you want to call that a Quinean?
Yeah, probably I should say a particular reading of the Quinean criterion that seems to me very intuitive. But it's not literally the Quinean criterion.
It's an alternative to Quine's.
Yeah, I think,
right?
yes.
So it is, in a sense, a rejection of Quine's criterion.
Yes.
Yes. So there was one slide where you said, well, we could reject Quine's criterion, but that's, in effect, what you're doing.
Okay, what I want to say is that it seems to me that we can save the gist of criterion when we say that. Obviously, if we quantify of something, we are assuming that in some sense these kind of entities exist because they say that they exist. Yeah, but you're right. Quine accept not substitutional quantification. Okay, but do you think it is a big problem for my talk in the sense that do you think?
No, I just think that you shouldn't say
that. You're right.
Maybe that
yes.
You want to preserve the Quinean criterion. In fact, some of what your data seems to go against is criterion, right? And then we can start
debating
that criterion versus an alternative criterion, which just seems to be what you're suggesting. Ultimately.
Yes, because the point seems to be, answered. The point seems to be that even if we accept deflationary, let's say quantification, deflationary semantical notions, in some sense we are committed to the existence of something in a deflationary sense. Of course, this is not the Quinean criterion. Yes, you're right. I'm proposing something different. Yes, you're right.
Same in spirit, different in letters.
Yes.
Amy.
I'm worried about. So you want to draw the line between these minimal entities and properly real entities like tables and chairs by saying that the minimal entities are just linguistic posits, really.
Yes.
What worries me is that it seems like what turns out to be a minimal entity, that is something that you arrive at the commitment of by way of these kinds of pre-analytic transformations, is somewhat arbitrary depending on what language you start with. So, for example, if you start with somebody like Ben Wagner, right, he's got the language where we're going to only quantify over simples arranged chair-wise, say, not over chairs. But it looks like from that language, there are simples arranged chair-wise, you can get to those of simple-wise arrangement of chairs, and then that's a shorthand for saying there's a chair. So we can get then this connection to chairs in much the same way, these kinds of transformations. But if that's the case, then if chairs also turn out to be minimal entities, then it looks like you'd be forced to say that chairs are just linguistic posits. But then you don't get this sort of contrast between what are those and what are.
Yeah, first, okay, you said that it depends on what language I'm focusing on, but I can say I'm focusing on ordinary language. Okay, and this could be an answer, but I don't think we can say that objects like chairs and ordinary objects are minimal entities because their ontology is much richer. I mean, ordinary, we assume that chairs have causal powers.
This is the point that I sort of wanted to bring up because yeah, we certainly do ordinary students, but also according to the limits about chairs, right, and plausibly here, right, chairs don't have any causal powers over and above those of their parts arranged chair-wise, right? So similarly, for at least some minimal entities, those aren't abstract, right? Things like particularized properties or states of affairs or something like that. But yeah, the fact that, or the same affairs of my cars being dented, can have figures and causal explanations. Right? Maybe those ultimately depend on things other than safety repairs on the car, right? But so similarly will the limitless say about ordinary objects that whatever causal powers are attributed to them can really be better attributed to those entities from which we can get these drive explanatic explanations.
I'm not sure I understood that. But it seems to me that an eliminativist about eliminativist about ordinary object is a revisionist about ordinary language.
Yes.
And I don't want to be a revisionist at all. And I try not to be a revisionist at all. I just accept what it seems to me in ordinary language is accepted. So I'm not sure I'm facing the problem you mentioned. I mean, you can say, of course, you can eliminate minimal entities. Yeah, you can eliminate everything. But this is not my problem. I mean, what I want to say is this. In our ordinary language, we have very weird objects, at least if we consider them from a metaphysical point of view. We can decide to get rid of them. We don't think of it. Who cares? Okay. You can endorse a very thick metaphysical point of view and so on. But what I'm interested in is this. Let's accept almost everything we accept in ordinary language and try to analyze these kind of objects. Do we arrive at some terrible conclusion, or we arrive at something which is after all coherent with our everyday picture, even if a little bit more regimented? And this is the problem. So of course you can get rid of them somehow, but this is not interesting for my analysis.
Certainly to argue for a limit to
the zero. Yeah,
I know. You're a big revision at all. I guess my only worry is that if you use this kind of commitment, you know, how we acquire commitment to these things, that it's by the dynastic transformations, as a criterion for whether they're really counting as real or not, that it seems that it's open to the objection of arbitrariness, given that, based on what language we're starting from when we engage in these. But maybe you just want to dig in your heels here and say, look, I only think that I do think there's a privilege for ordinary language. And given that privilege, I do think that we sort of have to refer to make our basic sentences true, are really real, but those that we derive from to run from advanced transformations aren't. I suppose that's an option to just, you know, give a kind of privilege to ordinary language over the language of the eliminativist or somebody who's doing something weird like that.
Okay. Yeah, but I don't know what to answer now.
Well, I feel like
do we agree on something? Please. Okay.
Wolfgang.
I don't think minimal entities are as harmless as you made them.
Okay.
Like.
Yeah.
So, for two reasons. One is you said that they're kind of completely characterized by the platitudes
by
which they're introduced. So the first reason is that we all know that those platitudes are inconsistent for the McCarthy-Russell kind of reason. So it seems to me it would be strange if there were entities that could be completely characterized by inconsistency.
No, wait, I stop you. Tell me this story better.
So take whatever, facts.
Yeah.
Facts are introduced by the schema S, if and only if it is a fact that S.
Yeah.
So let, what's the corresponding Tarski paradox? Let S be the effect, it is not the fact that
I understand. Okay, probably I have to put some constraints.
Yeah, yeah. So it seems that unrestricted, with properties, it's especially obvious that for cardinality reasons,
yeah, I know.
The principle must fail most of the time.
Yeah, I know.
First, that the other thing is that the way you characterize the minimal entities was that they have no other features than by this characterization. That seems very puzzling to me. So you say they're neither outside space-time nor inside space-time.
Yes.
They're neither absolute
or
concrete.
Yeah, yes.
That seems very puzzling to me. So especially it seems puzzling to me that I'm committed to such entities simply by saying it is a fact that it is private. I'm committed to entities that fail to satisfy logical trivialities that it seems to me obviously everything satisfies. So I would be very surprised if I was really committed to these strange entities. They're not harmless. Really?
Yes. Okay. So there are two issues here. The first, it's true. I have to provide some constraints for the minimal platitudes, otherwise I can face some paradoxes. And this is good. I have to think of it right. Above all, about properties, I know that problem. Yes. Second, I agree with you. They are very weird. These entities are weird. I don't want to say that I wake up in the morning and I feel I am committed to the existence of properties. The problem is that even if they are so weird, they are so thin, if you start thinking of them, after a while it seems to you that you are committed to them. Of course, you can reject this intuition and say, no, intuition of this feeling. No, because they don't exist in space and time, so it's impossible. They are too thin, that just define terms of platitude, so they cannot exist. But I want to know more than this. I want to have a clear answer why they don't exist.
But why not say, I'm committed to them, I'm a restricted principles, but it seems much more plausible to me that they're objects of an ordinary kind that are either in space-time or not in space-time, rather than these crazy objects that you say. Maybe the problem is just that I don't see what a thin object could be that neither satisfies the predicate nor not satisfies the predicate. It just seems to me that it's then the better option is to say, okay, there are these things, and now we have to answer for every property there is whether these things have them or not. It's not an option to say, well, no, they just have neither.
So you accept, I don't understand. You think that, for example, you can use minimal properties in meta-ethics. You can say Hitler was a bad guy, so Hitler had the property of being bad, morally bad. Okay, now I ask you, is this property something that exists in space and time? I'm not sure. I don't even know whether moral properties exist. And the function of minimal entities, in some cases, is to use this kind of, to use the word property in such tricky philosophical fields like ethics, because sometimes we need to quantify over something, but we don't want to be committed to what we are quantifying. Do you understand the point?
Would you say that the question, is this property either in space-time or outside space-time, or not in space-time? Would you say that's also false? It is neither in nor not in?
To be honest, I don't know what to think of this.
Because it seems to me that clearly everything either is in space-time or is not in space-time.
Of course. Infer from the claim that... Okay, wait. Consider this object. I think it's close to what you wanted to say. Consider two statements falling under the following schema. A is P. If this feature of A causes my perception that A is P, we can use this schema many times. Given platitude I and double I and 1, we can derive the property of being P is instantiated by A, and this feature of A causes my perception that A is P. From this, do you think we can conclude that minimal properties have causal powers? You see how it connects to your... Okay. I don't think so, to be honest. What's his name? I forgot. Orich has to face the same problem. Consider we start with the true statement that it is mind independent that S. From this given equivalence schema, we derive that it is mind independent that it is true that S. Okay, from this we can infer that truth now became a thick notion and it is not a minimal notion anymore. I don't think so. The minimalist Orich can say that no, it didn't become a thick notion because minimal truth is defined only in terms of the equivalence schema. It's just a logical tool to do something with language. Okay? Even if you add other features to the things you are speaking of, you don't make the essence of this notion different. So the minimalist about truth is not forced to admit what I said. And the same, I think, the minimalist about facts and properties doesn't have to admit this. Of course, you can say something that is a little bit problematic to me. You can say that as a result. Okay, you can say that if we admit that some minimal properties can be predicated somehow with causal powers, you can develop, for example, a causal theory of reference to these kind of properties. So they are not thin anymore, they become thick. But I have a reply. The reply is that this causal explanation, in quotation marks, is redundant because we know that minimal entities are minimal. So again, the best explanation of reference is given only in terms of deflationary notions. We can stick to this. I don't know why. So we don't need to make our notion thicker if we start dealing with complicated objects, ontologically complicated objects to which we apply our minimal notions. I think you had something in mind.
My worry was a bit less specific. I just wanted all entities to be complete. So for all entities, and any property should either have it or
okay.
have its negation.
Okay.
So you can't just refrain from asking.
You're right. Okay, so the issue is completeness.
Yeah.
Okay, this is good. I have to think of it. Okay. Thanks.
I mean, damn. It seemed like to me that the justification you're getting for something from nothing inferences, if it works, is able to justify the something from nothing inferences without requiring or presupposing that there are propositions, facts, and so on.
Okay.
I mean, that's how it seemed to me that it, I mean, for instance, if you're justifying why we say, use these terms in terms of, because you want to express an infinite disjunction, and that's the only way we can do it, by introducing, you know.
No, I don't understand the question.
Maybe I just misunderstood the justification you're giving for something for nothing. So I just understood.
Okay, which step? Because I was thinking the first step, which I called nominalization, I don't, and the second, existential step, okay, to be more poetic. So which step are you speaking of? Okay, go on.
One point you said, like, the logical function of this kind of language is to kind of express infinite disjunctions.
You can put it in this way, the infinite disjunction. Yes, go on. Yeah.
And that idea seems to, if that works, then it means that you give a justification of sentences that appear to quantify other propositions as what they're actually asserting is these infinite propositions, infinite disjunctions, which themselves are ontologically committed to facts or propositions or whatever. And so that allows you to show that the original sentences aren't actually committed to these entities.
No, I didn't see.
I
want to say is this, that in order to avoid, of course, in our language, since we are finite beings, we can use infinite long sentences. So we have to find a way to say something that is potentially applies to an infinite disjunction of conjunctions in a finite way. And I thought that the function, at least in some cases, of minimal entities is just to allow for this. Okay, in particular, we quantify on existential, on proposition, facts, and truths, and other entities, just to obtain such short expression, finite expression that stands for an infinite content. This is what I wanted to say. I don't understand how it relates with what you said.
So I just understood as the infinite disjunction itself doesn't actually entail that there's any propositions to be looked at, or any abstract objects to be looked at.
No.
Anyway. It's okay,
Okay.
I'm worried about answering the distinction between brute facts and institutional facts. Now, maybe one doesn't want to use the word fact in this case. Maybe you should say something about ways things are. But it seems to me that it's obvious that there are masses of ways things are, which are there, whether the propositions state they're being there, are there or not. All sorts of ways things were a long time ago. The propositions don't come into existence. And I think this makes propositions pretty substantial. Propositions are contingent beings. They come into existence with language and with believers and with thinkers. But there are brute facts, like dinosaurs roamed the earth, right? And there are institutional facts, like John checkmated Bill, or another institutional fact.
Okay.
I voted for Kevin Rudd.
Yeah.
Now, neither of those facts is capable of existing unless the concepts exist in order to state the propositions. Right? But these are institutional facts. Seem to me make facts pretty substantial because they can be there in some cases without the propositions. In other cases, there are facts whose very being depends on the propositions that would state them.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And this seems to me to be make both facts and propositions, they call the ways things are.
Okay.
It seems to me to make them damn substantial because they're all contingent beings which might or might not, or could or could not have come into existence. There might never have been the game of chess. There might never have been the human activity of elections. And then votes, and the fact that you voted for, or you voted for, that fact, right, not only would have obtained, it would have never obtained. It wouldn't have obtained the fact. So what is substantial about this?
No, but I don't deny that there are facts like those. I was speaking of minimal facts that, which are different, but I'm open to the possibility. Minimal facts. But I'm open to the possibility there are many other facts.
Yeah, but you're saying that they're insubstantial, that they're just projections, right?
Yeah, but...
But it seems to me the difference between brute facts, as Anselm calls them, and institutional facts is a very significant difference. And you can't treat those, and those are ways things are, which depend for their being on the concepts that are needed to express the propositions about them. So they're, and the concepts and the propositions are contingent entities. They don't exist except by the evolution and development of language. Right? The bits of the world that the language is about, you know, events, processes, and so forth, those are all contingent beings. They take place or don't take place, and many of them take place or don't take place or should take place in oblivion with respect to any bloody propositions.
Yeah. You know? Okay. No, but I don't understand how what you say connects to my talk. I mean, so I don't understand. Okay.
Jonathan. I thought that was the end of the answer.
Oh, okay. No, sorry, I didn't get it.
So maybe we can move to Jonathan.
We can speak later. You can explain. But I don't understand.
So I wanted to speak
closer
to you.
Speak slowly, please. Before, it was almost impossible to understand you further. Okay.
Now I'm getting the also.
Okay. No, but it's enough.
So I wanted to question.
Thank you.
To what extent you were avoiding revisionism? It was obviously very important to you that it was not a revisionary proposal. So it seemed to me that that your proposal was actually quite like Hofstadter's, in the sense that you were taking some of our quantificational discourse to have one sort of meaning, some sort of objectual quantifier, and some of it to map onto another sort of meaning entirely, this sort of substitutional quantifier. And I take it that to the extent that you're not revisionary, then you better think, wrong, that ordinary language idioms of quantification are semantically ambiguous between these two meanings. And now I want some, if you're not going to be a revisionist, I want some linguistic, real linguistic evidence for ambiguity, because I don't think there is any. So I mean, among standard sort of bits of evidence that people cite for ambiguity in a given language is the fact that there are other languages out there that translate the sort of allegedly ambiguous term into two distinct terms. I, to my knowledge, being very limited myself in my knowledge of languages, there just aren't these other languages. Moreover, when you've got ambiguities within a language, they're typically sort of one-off lexical accidents. You don't expect that there's sort of a system of expressions, all of which can express the same ambiguous meaning. And we have a system of ways of expressing existential quantification. So maybe you've got some fancy linguistic evidence that I'm not aware of, but to my knowledge of linguistic evidence, ordinary language existential quantification just isn't ambiguous. So I think, you're a revisionist. You're mapping our univocal discourse onto separate meanings to preserve this metaphysical distinction that you're sort of hoping to find.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, but this is a kind of question such that by this kind of... when you emphasize the ambiguity of language, you can destroy any possible metaphysical view because, I mean, of course, when you try to explain something, we create models, okay? And so we take into account that there is ambiguity, but we don't respect completely the ambiguity of the language. We think, in this case, we can focus on this particular aspect of the use of this quantifier. In this other case, we can focus on that other particular aspect. But maybe I didn't understand your question, but let me finish. What I want to say... No, but let me finish, because I ask you other questions. Okay. After all, I admitted that in ordinary language, we have at least two different uses of quantifiers. And of course, maybe when we use quantifiers in these two different ways, there are also ambiguities. But I'm sure that there is. We can also pick up some particular aspect and we can construct a model. Is this something that answers a little bit to your question? Or maybe I didn't understand.
Well, then I think you're being revisionary.
A little bit.
In the sense
yeah.
that I think
yeah.
Unless you have some
yeah.
better empirical evidence,
yes.
that the ordinary language use of quantification is univocal.
It's univocal.
Not ambiguous.
No, I don't believe so.
So I was giving you some first pass empirical evidence for univocality.
Okay.
And I was saying that if you're going to claim that you're giving a non-revisionary account
yeah.
of ordinary language, then you, I think, owe us some evidence
yeah.
for ambiguity in the language. And I spoke so. And here are some
okay.
standard bits of evidence. You know, gets translated into other languages in different terms,
yeah.
or that there isn't, that it's a one-off accident, there isn't a whole system of expressions that's allegedly ambiguous along exactly the same
okay.
ways. That's just saying that idioms of quantification look perfectly univocal by those tests.
Yes. Okay. So, yes, I'm to some degree revisionist. Okay, I admit it. I think it's impossible not to be revisionist at all if you want to do a little bit of philosophy. Don't you think? Analytic philosophy is construction of models. And if you construct a model, you are a little bit revisionist.
Richard.
Yeah, I was just wondering if this is another way of looking at what you just did in your talk. And that is to say, look, you've got these pleonastic inferences where you seem to get something from nothing. And what you're arguing is that, yes, you get something from nothing, but what you get is only this very minimal, very, very thin thing. You're not going to get anything thick. And in fact, it's so minimal that it's perhaps not complete. It's a weird kind of thing. It's not going to have causal powers, any of that. So it's very minimal. And then you say that you give some story about it being a linguistic posit to explain how there could
yes.
be these
okay.
really thin, minimal things
yeah.
That we're committed to.
Yes.
Then they're just these deflationary tools for blind quantification.
Yeah, I can agree on this, yes.
In which case, yes, you're not talking about different kinds of facts, you don't have to worry about not fit facts. All you're saying is you don't get them out of
yes.
inferences. You can say, yes, they're not complete entities that satisfy disjunctive syllogism because they're not really things in any real sense. They're just these deflationary posits.
Okay.
And it was connected, I thought, might connect with Amy's question as well. Because if you started with a different language and made these sort of pleonastic moves, your claim is, yes, you could do that from a different language, and you'd end up with other things, chairs maybe, but they'd only be minimal chairs, they're not these things that you end up with. So, yes, there's all kinds of, you know, it's arbitrary in that sense, but all you're claiming is that all you get out of these inferences are these minimal entities.
Yeah, okay, I agree, and what's now
It wasn't a question.
Okay, yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. So instead of inferences from something from nothing, it's almost nothing from nothing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, that was a nice little segue. What I was going to say is that really what you're saying is you are getting nothing from nothing. Maybe I can. I'm not going to disagree with you, I'm not going to question what you're saying, I'm going to try and see if I can understand what you're saying by interpreting it, by restating it in other words. I'm going to agree with Lloyd that there was a time once when dinosaurs did roam the earth, and that is what happened to be the case. In addition to that, there is no extant fact, there's no fact with ontological purchase which is the fact that dinosaurs roam the earth. You don't need, that would almost be an error of overdetermination. Now you've not only got dinosaurs roaming the earth, but you have this other separate existing fact that says that dinosaurs roam the earth.
Yes.
But that doesn't exist. What existed is that dinosaurs roam the earth
yes.
in the first place.
Yes.
So in this sense, you are getting nothing from nothing. By creating this fact, you don't get anything extra. And you cannot claim any sort of ontological purchase. You can't say that this fact exists in its own right.
Yes.
It doesn't exist beyond the case that dinosaurs once roamed.
Yes, okay.
Is that what you're trying to
say?
I
think so, yes. You can put it in this way also. But there is another problem. I didn't want to deal with it. Maybe there is no time. It seems to me that from what you said, I'm not sure completely. You want to say that if there was no word, real word, there wouldn't be also, there would be no minimal fact as well. I mean, I'm not allowed to. Do you want to say something?
Except in a purely epistemic domain, you wouldn't have an ontological fact. You'd have epistemic facts. You'd have facts in language.
Yes.
You say they are linguistic posits. You could have linguistic posits.
Yeah.
But they would not correspond to any. Here I say.
Yeah, but there is a problem here, because there is a proof given by Schiffer, according to which propositions and properties exist necessarily in all possible worlds. And so it seems that they have their existence is completely disconnected from anything, let's say, material, which exists independently, exists for real. In that case, you can say that also he calls this minimal entities as well, these kind of objects. So you can say that in this case you get something from nothing. I don't know if you understand.
Yeah, I do understand.
But I think the proofs are not fallacious. I couldn't speak of it now.
Okay. I won't hold up the procedure. I actually think that those possible worlds, in fact, esteemed worlds, they're not ontological.
Yes.
Real worlds. They're just epistemic domains.
Yeah, you're right. Yes.
Which means that they're still linguistic possibilities.
Yeah, you're right. They're, yes, yes. Okay, so I agree.
So you agree with that?
Yes,
so I understand what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Let's thank Luca.